Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this programme, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the move by the Hindu nationalist government in India to outlaw a Muslim political outfit and its affiliates over terror charges. And we shall also look at the relentless Daesh terrorist attacks on the Hazara Shia community in Afghanistan and growing calls for security, justice, and accountability.
The Hindu nationalist government in India has just recently outlawed a Muslim political outfit and its affiliate organizations, accusing them of involvement in criminal and terror cases. It came after multiple raids and arrests of over 250 members of the outfit in several Indian states. The vicious crackdown on the members and supporters of the Popular Front of India, followed by the ban, has been described as a witch hunt by Muslim activists in the country. It comes amid growing religious polarization under the BJP government.
The Popular Front of India, a lesser-known political outfit that claims to represent Muslims in India and its affiliate organizations, were on September 27 declared unlawful under the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act by the Narendra Modi government. An order issued by India's Home Ministry accused them of raising funds in India and abroad as part of a well-crafted criminal conspiracy. The ministry said the PFI and its affiliates were engaged in activities prejudicial to the integrity, sovereignty, and security of the country. Besides the PFI itself, organizations linked to it, including Rehab India Foundation, Campus Front of India, All India Imams Council, National Confederation of Human Rights Organization, National Women's Front, Junior Front, Empower India Foundation, and Rehab Foundation have also been banned. The Campus Front of India, the PFI student wing, denounced the ban as undemocratic and unconstitutional, vowing to challenge it in the apex court. The ban came days after at least 250 PFI leaders and workers across 15 Indian states were arrested.
The banning of the Popular Front of India has been in the air for quite a while. It never really impacted a large part of the country, and it was confined to the southern states, largely Kerala and Karnataka, for instance. There have been allegations against them for violence and for acts of terror, but it wasn't such a big thing. So if have they been arrested or banned primarily because of witch hunt, I'm not really sure. But I think what the government has been trying to, what the Nationalist Party has been trying to do, is to show up these outfits as terror outfits, and largely to show that the a section of the minority is synonymous with terror. That is a grander plan, and that is where PFI really fits in.
The PFI, created in 2007 through the merger of three Muslim organizations in southern India, describes itself as an outfit that works towards the achievement of socio-economic, cultural, and political empowerment of the deprived and the downtrodden and the nation at large.
Radical Hindu groups allied with India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party had long demanded a ban on the Popular Front of India. It comes as minority Muslims in the country have in recent years complained of marginalization under the Hindu Nationalist Federal Government. The ban on the Muslim outfit and arrests of its leaders has evoked a mixed response, with some welcoming the move and others decrying it. However, it has led to unanimous calls countrywide for similar measures against radical Hindu organizations involved in crimes against Muslims.
The Popular Front of India, according to a mission statement posted on its website, seeks to establish an egalitarian society where everyone enjoys freedom, justice, and a sense of security. It claims to speak for Muslims as well as other minorities, including lower caste Dalits and tribals. However, that has not prevented the BJP government from invoking charges such as sedition, creating enmity in society, and destabilizing India against the outfit and its members. A lawyer representing the PFI was quoted as saying that the government failed to produce any evidence of the group receiving international funding for terror activities in India. The Social Democratic Party of India, a group that works with PFI but has not been included in the ban, slammed the Modi government for misusing the investigation agencies and using laws to silence the opposition and to scare the people from expressing the voice of dissent. The ban has evoked a mixed response. Asaduddin Owaisi, a leading Indian Muslim politician, said the ban on PFI cannot be supported. He argued that the way India's electoral autarky is approaching fascism, every Muslim youth will now be arrested with a PFI pamphlet under India's black law. The opposition Congress party welcomed the ban, but said the BJP's ideological parent, RSS, should be similarly outlawed.
When law is not applied equally on every member of the society, that really undermines the rule of law and the democracy on which it is at rest. And I think it's hurtful for democracy if an action is taken which is not just and grounded in rule of law. But having said that, that is the nature of many societies which we are witnessing. There's a heavy bias in favor of the people who are in power. They are totally unmindful of what the majority of the people really think or conduct themselves, and ordinary people really have to suffer because of that.
Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Mohammad Salman, president of Student Islamic Organization of India, says the ban on Popular Front of India is a worrying development for all citizens and constitutes a threat to democracy and freedom. Samiullah Khan, a journalist and activist, asserts that the ban on PFI is unjust and an attempt to cripple the Muslim community, adding that he has witnessed the Muslim outfit's humanitarian work. Senior Indian politician and parliamentarian Asaduddin Owaisi calls the ban on PFI draconian and says it is a ban on any Muslim who wishes to speak his mind.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The Hazara Shia community in Afghanistan faced yet another colossal tragedy just recently. A suicide bomber attacked an educational institute in the predominantly Shia neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi in West Kabul, killing at least 53 people and wounding many others. No group claimed responsibility for the carnage, but the Daesh terrorist group has in the past been involved in such horrific crimes against the persecuted community, especially since the Taliban made a dramatic comeback after trouncing the US-led coalition forces last year.
On September 30th, a suicide bomber stormed a popular educational center in West Kabul's Shia-populated neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi, opened indiscriminate fire, and then detonated his explosives when around 400 students, mostly girls, were taking tuition for the university entrance exam. The UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan said the massive explosion killed at least 53 people, including 46 girls and women, and wounded more than 110 others. The casualty figure is likely to rise further. All names need documenting and remembering, and justice must be done, the mission asserted. No group has claimed responsibility for the attacks so far, but the persecuted Hazara community has often been targeted by the Daesh terrorist group, which has seen resurgence since the Taliban's comeback last year, effectively filling the vacuum left by the U.S.-led NATO forces. The terrorist group, which has its own rivalry with the Taliban, was involved in a similar suicide attack on an education center in the same neighborhood in 2020, which killed at least 24 students. In May 2021, it carried out another devastating attack near a school in Dashtabarchi, killing more than 85 people. The unchecked attacks have put added pressure on the de facto government in Kabul to ensure the safety and security of vulnerable ethnic minorities.
Amongst the harrowing scenes following the recent bombing was a grief-stricken mother mourning the death of her two young sons, a helpless father running helter-skelter in search of his missing daughter, a distraught brother waiting in a hallway for his critically injured sister to recover. With the international community maintaining a deafening silence over the Daesh carnage and the Western media willfully downplaying it, the Hazara Shia activists have in recent days taken to the streets of Kabul demanding tighter security as well as justice and accountability.
Since 2014, when Daesh terrorist group made its first inroads in the country, it has been relentlessly bombing mosques, schools and hospitals that belong to the Hazara Shia community. Dashtabarchi and other smaller pockets inhabited by Shias in the Afghan capital have been turned into killing fields. Although the Taliban claim that its approach toward the ethnic minorities, including Hazara Shias, has changed, the failure to protect the community from the Daesh onslaught has drawn anger and outrage. Over the past few days, members of the Hazara Shia community have held a series of demonstrations in Kabul and other major cities, including Mazar-e-Sharif, Herat and Bamia, against the ongoing genocide. Slogans such as "Stop Hazara Genocide" and "It's not a crime to be a Shia" have been reverberating across the country, especially amid the deafening silence in the West. The de facto Taliban government has vowed to enhance the security of the persecuted community and send its representative to the families of the victims of Friday's bombing. In a statement, the Taliban Foreign Ministry condemned the attack as the work of malicious networks and a conspiracy by the enemies of Afghanistan to create divisions among the Afghan people. However, the victims just want justice.
Now to have more insight, we are once again joined by Mr. Mustafa Ariyayi, author at COVID Action Magazine from the Netherlands. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ariyayi. Now, we witnessed another devastating tragedy for the Hazara Shia minority in Afghanistan just recently. Again, the school was targeted and young children were killed. Now, why do these attacks continue to be unchecked?
Yes. First, I would like to convey my deepest condolences to the families of the martyrs. May the Almighty grant their loved ones patience and strength to overcome yet another horrible tragedy that left so many casualties. Let me tell you that the latest cascade of attack is not the first one and most likely won't be the last one. And indeed, the war has not came to an end, as opposed to what many people believe to be the case. These attacks unfortunately culminated in the killing of many innocent, young and well-educated young boys and girls. The sworn enemy of our country won't rest until they have achieved their objectives, namely the total dissolution of the state entity, and with it, the pride of its people. These attacks not only targeted Hazaras, but equally so other ethnic groups who have suffered enormously for the past four decades of war. And the carnage that was imposed upon them. Unfortunately, the suffering will continue. And the attack against Hazara and Tajiks, as well as other groups, obviously, in our country, deserve the harshest condemnation. Yet the international community of states, say for some entities, has been remarkably silent on the ongoing suffering of the Afghan nation. And that indeed emboldened terrorists. What I also would like to add is that the country is already facing a humanitarian crisis unknown in scale. Yet these leaders who were traditionally supporting the Hazara, our Hazara compatriots, did not lift a finger to support them. They live outside the country enjoying an extravagant lifestyle, which does not resonate with how the vast majority of Afghanis are living right now, which is in an impoverished state while simultaneously being subjected to terrorist attacks. And furthermore, Afghan girls have been deprived from the right of education. So you can imagine what kind of a discrepancy that has brought about. And really, it's horrible.
Ms. Arya, most of these attacks targeting the persecuted Hazara Shia community in Kabul and in other Afghan cities in recent years were claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. So the question is, which powers are behind this terrorist group?
Right. I mean, let's say for what it is, there is no significant difference between old allies, the Taliban and Daesh. They derive their ideology from the same source, since they are both strongly adhering to Wahhabism and Salafism through the madrasa schools that were established in Pakistan during the Cold War. And these schools were financed by the West and by the Persian Gulf states. So we see the implications of it back then, and we do see it now as terrorist groups are expanding their presence in Afghanistan. And that obviously should be perceived with high suspicion, as it poses an existential threat to neighboring countries, for Iran and Central Asian republics in particular. So there are no beneficiaries when terrorists gain more foothold in Afghanistan. Let me be very clear about that. The opposite is in fact the case. The terrorist group Daesh enjoys financial and moral support from the Persian Gulf states, as well as the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Daesh failed miserably in Syria and Iraq due to the Iranian and Russian efforts, but we already saw that the Afghan Defense Ministry, who was logistically supported by the United States, utilized military helicopters to replace Daesh elements from the south to the north of the country. And it seems that the outside powers still have a stake in supporting terrorists to advance their geopolitical objectives in Central Asia and beyond. And that indeed poses a great threat. Moreover, historically, the Afghan National Army was dissolved when jihadi groups came to power. And after that, the country did not have a strong defensive force that could defend the country against potential threats or potential terrorist groups. Pakistan, for its part, played a huge role in abolishing the, an army that was capable of defending the country's border against outside threats or against external threats. And that, unfortunately, is not the case anymore. We have a very weak army, and we have porous borders, which should be easily penetrated by outsiders.
Now, Ms. Arya, the Taliban came back to power last year after 20 years of foreign military occupation with a promise to ensure security of all ethnic minorities. Now, is it fair to say that the group has failed to live up to that promise?
Oh, absolutely. The Taliban was primarily responsible for the security vacuum in the last 20 years. They were conducting what they coined as a holy war against the infidels. And the Taliban, a priori, willingly and knowingly, were not interested in bringing a perpetual peace and security to the country. They never really had any such aims to begin with. The Taliban were included in so-called reconciliation efforts by former Western-backed government headed by Karzai and Ahmadzai, the latter two of which explicitly designated the Taliban as their dissatisfied brothers, quote-unquote. and tried hard to bring them at the expense of the lives of many unknown numbers of innocent compatriots within the Afghan political spectrum. The Taliban were bolstered by the two aforementioned puppet presidents and formally came to power by means of a quid pro quo as established by Zalmay Khalilzad in the failed state of Afghanistan. So the Taliban, as well as Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai, were never genuinely interested in an inclusive government. Their attitude towards the Persian speakers of Afghanistan is shocking, to say the least. In fact, to that end, policies were conducted to diminish the influence of the Persian language in Afghanistan. And today's Taliban is pretty much a reminiscent of the era of Hafiz Amin. And Hafiz Amin was a Pashtun nationalist who was responsible for the death of thousands of predominantly Tajiks as well as Hazaras. And he was eventually assassinated by the Soviets. However, many former Pashtun nationalist leaders, forming an integral part of the former Haki party, are now a part of the Taliban. So you can pretty much compare that the way in which former Ba'athist generals in Iraq formed an integral part of ISIS. And pretty much the same, unfortunately, happened in Afghanistan. And we see that now coming into fruition. But this subject should be discussed in another segment, I guess. But the Taliban has not and will not live up to its promise. That's for sure. And, they too are an instrument for outside powers. They do not, by any stretch of the imagination, operate autonomously. And they still have ties with the Pakistani ISI. And other foreign intelligence services.
One last question, Mr. Ariyai. Why don't we see any significant coverage of Daesh crimes in Afghanistan in the Western media? And why Afghan lives, well, it seems like this, why Afghan lives don't matter to them?
Absolutely. It's really important to understand that Western mainstream media, their modus operandi is very, very predicated on a very selective approach. So I think one should be very accurate as on closer inspection, at least. Not only is the issue of Daesh and Taliban crimes objectively absent in Western mainstream media, but it looks like that we see a repetition of parallel events. I could recall how some terrorists were branded as moderates, whereas others were destined to be the arch enemy of the forces trying to contain them. In retrospect, it was nothing but a poor attempt to prolong a conflict and thereby stoking more violence, culminating in the disintegration of a sovereign state. And we see the same being played out again in Afghanistan, because historically, Syria and the former Democratic Republic of Afghanistan are without a doubt cases in point to show how terrorists are actually utilized or instrumentalized by Western media in order to demonize a government that is not prone to the collective West. Daesh and the Taliban are two pieces of the same cake, which both have served outside forces in the past and will most likely do so in the future. Therefore, there is no need to receive bad media coverage unless they should serve as a pretext for never-ending wars and bloodshed. And that is the explanation that I can give on that point.
There you have it, Mr. Ariyai. It's always great to have you here on the program. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
UK-based university researcher Rabia Khan notes a slow but steady shift in language, with words such as massacre and attack being replaced by genocide and Shia with Hazara after recent attacks against the Hazara community in Afghanistan. Bharat Ali Batur, a photographer and filmmaker, urges the international community, United Nations and other entities, to move beyond hollow statements of condemnation on the genocide of Hazara Shias in Afghanistan. Afghan-Australian scholar and author Farhonda Akbar says the latest attack is part of genocidal campaign against Hazaras, as targeting youth in educational centers has become a salient feature of Hazara genocide.
And that was our episode about the Indian government's crackdown on Muslim political organizations and the genocide of Afghanistan's persecuted Hazara Shia community. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Even before Hurricane Ian made landfall in the U.S. state of Florida, the situation of insurance in this state was a disaster. Experts have presented even a more grim picture of the situation in Florida these days. In this regard, we have taken a look at World Media for further details. Stay tuned, please. Politico wrote, "The storm inundated the homes of thousands of Floridians who don't have flood insurance, exposing weaknesses in the U.S. effort to address the rising cost of extreme weather. Hurricane Ian is expected to financially ruin countless people in Florida whose homes were not covered by flood insurance, and the storm inundated the region with powerful ocean surges and damaging downpours. The personal financial losses are a reflection of Ian's intensity and the fact that millions of Americans nationwide haven't bought flood insurance. The federal government's National Flood Insurance Program, the dominant source of flood coverage in the U.S., protects only a tiny fraction of homeowners, almost all of them in coastal areas. Ian's web of damage was unusually widespread as the hurricane drove a storm surge onto coastal areas and triggered river overflows and flash flooding across inland Florida, where almost nobody has flood insurance. Joe Biden declared 9 counties disaster areas, making residents eligible for federal aid to pay for minor home repairs, storm-term housing, and other emergency costs. But of the 1.8 million households in those 9 counties, only 29% have federal flood insurance, according to an analysis of government records of Politico's E&E News. That leaves 1.3 million households at ground zero without federal flood coverage. In Hardy County, only 100 households have federal flood insurance out of 8,000 households in the country. That's a 1.3% coverage rate. Hardy has one of the lowest income levels of any Florida county, and 44% of its residents are Hispanic. Ian could financially ruin households of families in Florida. There is no better way to say it, said Mark Friendlander of the Insurance Information Institute. Flood coverage is not included in homeowners' insurance policies. That forces people to buy food insurance separately, though almost no one who lives inland from a coastal area does. The vast majority of flood coverage in the U.S. is sold through the Federal Emergency Management Agency's National Flood Insurance Program. It is unclear how many people have flood policies through private insurers. Friend Lander said people without flood insurance could be devastated. At the same time, the damage caused by Ian's winds could plunge Florida's private insurance market into deeper chaos, potentially forcing additional insurers into insolvency and triggering a surcharge on almost every insurance policy in the state. The Insurance Information Institute, an industry-funded research group, estimates that Ian has caused at least $30 billion in damage. That would make it roughly the 12th costliest U.S. disaster since 1980, according to NOAA records. Ian hit Florida as the state faces an insurance crisis. Policyholders dare pay the nation's highest property insurance rates, and huge losses have forced six small Florida-based insurers into insolvency this year, while others have stopped writing new policies. That has pushed homeowners into Citizens Property Insurance Corporation, the state-backed insurer of last resort. The number of its policy holders has doubled in the past 2 years and recently passed 1 million for the first time since 2014. Insurer losses are due to a combination of extensive legal claims and huge payouts and policies in states such as Louisiana, which has faced two catastrophic storms since 2020. The bad news is that flood coverage varies widely across Florida and among the counties that have faced the worst damage from Ian. In nine counties that Biden declared a disaster, coverage rates for flood damage range from 1.3% in Hardy County and 3.2% in DeSoto County to 67% in Collier County, which is in the state's southwest corner and is one of Florida's richest counties. Some parts of Florida suffered huge flooding and are not among the nine counties that Biden declared a disaster. Orlando, which is Florida's third largest city, experienced up to 15 inches of rain and saw flash floods, according to the National Weather Service. The city has 130,000 households. Yet records show that only 2,039 buildings are covered by federal flood insurance. That's a coverage rate of 1.5%. Inland flooding caused by Ian highlights the fact that as climate is changing storm patterns, we're seeing lots of flooding away from the coast from stalled hurricanes and intense precipitation. People without flood insurance will have to rely on FEMA aid, which is capped at $72,000 but usually results in payments of less than $10,000. Also, NPR wrote, even before Hurricane Ian made landfall in Florida, the state's property insurance market was already in its own state of disaster. Homeowners in Florida pay the highest premiums in the country, nearly three times the national average, according to the Insurance Information Institute, an industry group. And Floridians' premiums are rising much faster, about 33% each year, than the typical American annual increase of 9%. But in Florida, hurricanes aren't the only factor driving up costs. Rampant litigation and soaring reinsurance costs are other components, experts say. Six insurance carriers have declared insolvency this year alone. Others have dropped customers or stopped writing new policies. As a result, the number of policyholders $1,000 on a state-backed insurer of last resort, Citizens Property Insurance has ballooned. Now, as Floridians look to recover from an estimated tens of billions of dollars in damage caused by the Category 4 storm, some have worried that Ian could be the final straw for even more private insurers, driving up costs and sending Florida's precarious insurance market closer to catastrophe.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It started in February 2022, and there seems to be no end in sight. While the Ukrainian military has made some advances, Russia still controls some 20% of the country, and there's nothing that suggests that this war is winding down. The Ukrainian military is backed up by Western weapons and Western intelligence gathering, which tells them where Russian soldiers are and where their bases are located. In the latest in its long list of support for Ukraine, the U.S. Congress has passed another aid for Kiev, which amounts to some $12 billion. And this is on top of nearly $50 billion sent there in the past year. But apart from all the weapons, cash, and intelligence sent and given to Ukraine, reports are emerging that the U.S. has sent men on the ground there. A recent report released by an American news organization, The Intercept, stated that the U.S. Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Ukraine as part of a broad covert operation that includes CIA personnel. According to the report, before the Russian special military operation, the CIA believed Ukraine would fall quickly and so withdrew most of its forces and assets. But later on, as the war lengthened, the CIA began to believe that that wouldn't happen, and Washington sent its covert assets back into Ukraine. But all this back and forth between Russia and Ukraine and the West's unilateral support for Kiev has given rise to a new crisis, one which doesn't only involve the two warring sides anymore, and that is nuclear warfare. On Thursday, at a fundraiser in New York, U.S. President Joe Biden made an extraordinary and, as some say, highly alarming comments about the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war and the threat of a nuclear war. Biden said the risk of nuclear Armageddon is at its highest point since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. But the question which comes to mind is whether this admission is a result of the Biden administration's policy of supporting Ukraine in a war on Russia's border or Moscow's actions so far. Russian President Vladimir Putin has spoken out about using nuclear weapons, but never directly stated that he will use them. During his speech, however, Biden stated that Putin is not joking when he talks about the use of tactical nuclear weapons. The last time the U.S. was faced with such a situation was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which then President John F. Kennedy resolved through negotiations and striking a deal with Cuba. Biden, however, has so far shown no signs of walking back on its policies regarding Ukraine, and this has been clear in the U.S. not showing any interest in diplomacy and virtually cutting off all high-level talks. Not only this, Biden has time and again reiterated his support for Kiev, and the billions of dollars of aid is only a demonstration of the fact. Following the West's unconditional and unilateral support, Kiev has also pushed matters a step further, and is now calling for strikes on Russia. Also, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, called for NATO to launch what he called a preventive strike on Russia to prevent Moscow from using nuclear weapons. But this has raised questions about Kiev's ambitions and the chances that the move would spark World War III and possibly a nuclear war. The Kremlin also responded to the comment and said Zelensky was trying to spark a world war. The remark gave birth to internal disputes in Kiev, with Ukrainian officials downplaying what Zelensky said. Now, as the world is faced with several economic, social, and environmental challenges, the warmongering aspirations of the US and its allies seem to have pushed humanity to the point of no return. But many, including Washington and Kiev, seem to be more focused on pushing their own agenda forwards, regardless of what's at stake.
As the crisis in Ukraine is getting worse, chances for a diplomatic solution to the war are looking slim. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has signed a decree that formally declares the prospect of any Ukrainian talks with Kremlin leader Vladimir Putin, quote, impossible. The decree also approves the decision of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council to strengthen Ukrainian defense. The decree came after Russia annexed four regions of Ukraine into its own territory. President Putin has just signed into law four unification treaties with the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, as well as the Kherson and Zaporozhye region. Russia says Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics split from Ukraine in 2014 following what Kremlin describes as the Maidan coup. Russia's decision to incorporate the regions into its own territory comes amid reports of Ukraine's military advances. According to President Zelensky, Ukrainian forces have retaken dozens of villages from Russia in the east and the south of the country. However, the latest maps revealed by Moscow showed Russian troops had already left many areas in Kherson and northeastern Kharkiv region.
Тільки за цю добу на Херсонщині від псевдореферендуму було звільнено і стабілізовано такі населені пункти, як Нововоскресенське, Новогригорівка і Петропавлівка. Рух продовжить.
Ukraine is now trying to make further inroads in the south and east before the colder weather arrives. Russia is trying to deploy the 300,000 reservists called up in a partial mobilization 2 weeks ago. But that would take some time before it can be operational. The developments come as the U.S. is sending more weapons into Ukraine.
This morning, President Biden spoke with President Zelensky to underscore that the United States will never recognize Russia's purported annexation of Ukrainian territory and will continue to support Ukraine as it defends itself from Russian aggression. President Biden informed President Zelensky that the United States is providing a new $625 million security assistance package to Ukraine as they continue to defend their country from Russia's invasion.
The new $625 million military package approved by the Biden administration includes additional weapons and equipment, including HIMARS, artillery systems and ammunition, and armored vehicles. The United States has now sent Ukraine more than $16.8 billion in military hardware. Russia has now warned that the shipment of new military hardware to Ukraine will risk direct confrontation with the United States. The supply of military products by the US and its allies not only entails protracted bloodshed and new casualties, but also increases the danger of a direct military clash between Russia and Western countries. Concerns are now rising over a possible nuclear confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has already warned that his threat to use nuclear weapons is not a bluff. The war in Ukraine has already caused a crisis for the European Union. Energy prices have soared and the rising cost of living is putting many Europeans into poverty.
We have now to limit this inflationary impact of gas on electricity and everywhere in Europe. This is why we are ready to discuss a cap on the price of gas that is used to generate electricity. This cap would also be a first step on the way to a structural reform, an overall reform of our electricity market.
There are now signs that the support for Ukraine amongst Europeans is dropping. A survey by YouPinion's pollster has revealed that 60% of EU's population were on board with sending weapons to Kiev. The number was 64% back in March. It now appears that the lingering crisis in Ukraine could lead to social unrest across the continent. European leaders are concerned over the rise of far-right groups which could potentially create cracks within the anti-Moscow coalition in Brussels.
Back in April, a temporary UN-mediated ceasefire was reached between Yemen's Ansarullah movement and the Saudi-led coalition. It was renewed twice, leading to a respite from a bloody war that has ravaged the country for years, killing 150,000 people. The Saudi kingdom and its allies, most notably the United Arab Emirates, have been waging a war against Yemen since March 2015, trying in vain to reinstall the exiled Saudi-friendly regime of Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi. The military campaign, which has been enjoying arms, logistic, intelligence, and political support from the United States and some other Western countries, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and turned Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Now, the truce has ended, with sides failing to reach a consensus about the renewal of the ceasefire. In a statement, the Ansarullah movement has blamed the impasse on the Saudi-led coalition's failure to live up to its commitments and its reluctance to address humanitarian issues as a top priority. It also slammed Saudi Arabia and its allies for their refusal to talk about measures that would alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people. Yemeni Foreign Minister Hisham Sharaf Abdullah also said the other side's failure to respond to the purely humanitarian demands presented by Sana'a has confirmed, beyond any doubt, its lack of seriousness in moving towards reaching a comprehensive and sustainable peaceful political settlement. Meanwhile, Yemen's armed forces have put oil companies operating in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on notice, warning that they could be targeted as long as Riyadh and its allies fail to commit to a proper ceasefire. Sana'a says the coalition has repeatedly violated the humanitarian and military armistice. On April 10th, only a week after the agreement came into force, the Saudi coalition committed over 1,600 violations, including offensive operations, airstrikes, overflights by warplanes, spy planes, and Apache helicopters, as well as missile and artillery targets, resulting in the death of a number of people. And until the end of the ceasefire on October the 2nd, the number of violations of the coalition forces has reached over 34,500. So, apparently from the very beginning, Riyadh and its allies were not serious and honest about efforts to end the war. UN has expressed its disappointment with the failure to extend Yemen's truce, saying negotiations are underway for a potential extension to the ceasefire, urging calm on the warring sides. But what will happen if the fighting resumes? The ceasefire has brought a sharp drop in fighting in the war, but now millions will once again be at risk of airstrikes, ground shelling, and missile attacks. Also, with the ceasefire in place, the daily lives of the Yemeni people dramatically improved. Fuel imports into the port of Hodeidah have quadrupled, while more essential goods entered the blockaded country and prices came down. In addition, the international charity Save the Children said the truce had led to a 60% decrease in displacement and a 34% drop in child casualties in Yemen. The Saudi-led military campaign had caused the internal displacement of 4.3 million Yemenis by March 2022. Humanitarian organizations have called on both sides to extend the arm of diplomacy, pointing out that 8 to 23 million people out of a total population of 30 million will be severely affected. So, if the humanitarian and military armistice is not renewed, everything will go back to square one. the risk of a large-scale famine, violence, collapsing services, and protracted displacement are the biggest challenges in Yemen now. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has severely censured the unrest that erupted in some parts of Iran following the death of a young woman, stating that the deadly riots were orchestrated in advance by the United States and the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comment in an address to military cadets in Tehran, saying he was saddened by the death of a young woman, which triggered the riots. Protests over the death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fainted at a police station and was later pronounced dead at a hospital, erupted first in her native province of Kurdistan and later spread to other parts of the country, including Tehran. The leader said reactions to the incident were not normal. The riots were not natural, as groups of people caused social disturbances on the streets, burned copies of the Holy Quran, harassed veiled women, and set mosques, religious congregational halls, and private cars on fire. According to a statement released by the Iranian intelligence ministry, the rioters have been backed by Western regimes and their mercenary media, who disseminated misinformation and distorted the sequence of events that led to Amini's death, even before the official investigation into the incident concludes. Also, the intelligence ministry said 9 people from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, and other countries have been arrested for their role in the riots. From the very beginning, different Western media began a campaign against Iran voicing support for the rioters. That's why they have remained silent for years about the strict sanctions imposed on Iran. Meanwhile, a teenage girl named Zainab Essa Majid al-Khazali was killed during American military drills near a U.S. military camp close to the international airport in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. There was an effective blackout on the death in Western media. So why are they refusing to show the same sensibility about Zainab's death? Seemingly, what matters most is creating turmoil in the stable nations in West Asia. Shortly after the death of Mahsa Amini, allegations of mistreatment and even torture surfaced on social media platforms, and Western media outlets lost no time in picking up the story and willfully distorting it. Before any official statement was made, Iran was accused of deliberate killing, and Mahsa was brutally killed by Iranian police was the talk of the town. Unsurprisingly, these headlines come as part of a systematic campaign to attack Iran and cause turmoil in the country.
There have been more anti-government protests in the Iranian capital, Tehran.
Just a moment ago, protests spreading in the country of Iran over the death of a young woman earlier this month.
The protests in Iran.
In addition, for years, the West, particularly the United States, has been trying to stop Iran's progress by using economic sanctions, military threats, cyber attacks, and assassinations. In his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. and its allies' main problem is a strong and independent Iran and the country's progress. He pointed to the country's progress in all sectors, efforts aimed at facilitating domestic production, activation of knowledge-based companies, and the country's ability to neutralize Western sanctions. The leader said that enemies are gravely mistaken in their calculations, and their plots will not yield anything at all. And he's right. Iranians once again foiled the enemy's plots after huge crowds of people took to the streets across Iran to denounce acts of vandalism and desecration of Islamic sanctities by rioters, sending a strong message that Iran's security and stability is the most important issue.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
On the day when Russian President Vladimir Putin was forced to carry out a special operation in Ukraine in order to prevent the West and NATO's expansionist policies, he also announced that goals of this operation are to denazify Ukraine and save the people of Donbass and Luhansk regions from the oppression of the Western-backed regime in Kiev. Since the beginning of the operation, Russian and Ukrainian officials have made many verbal threats against each other, but one of these threats that was widely reflected by the media is that recently the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky asked the West to carry out a preventive nuclear strike against Russia. Russian officials say this threat by Zelensky can endanger not only the security of the region, but also the security of the entire world. We have taken at the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Sputnik news agency writes, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov urged the entire world to take note of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's call for a preventive nuclear strike against Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, Zelensky's statement about preventive nuclear strikes against Russia cannot be ignored by the international community, since they are nothing short of a call to start a world war, which will entail catastrophic repercussions. The Kremlin spokesman stressed that the United States and Britain, which de facto run Kiev, should bear responsibility for Zelensky's statement. Dmitry Peskov said, "These are United States and Britain that are the de facto directors of Kiev, manages activities and talk about their intentions to defend Ukraine to the bitter end. Therefore, they are responsible and should be held accountable for this person's actions and statements." For her part, Maria Zakharova, a spokeswoman for the Russian Foreign Ministry, has warned that the West is fomenting a nuclear war, while an unstable Zelensky has turned into a monster. Maria Zakharova wrote on her Telegram channel, "Every single person on this planet should realize that Zelensky, a puppet and an unstable character who has been pumped with weapons, has turned into a monster who could be used to destroy the planet." Reacting to the Ukrainian president's remarks, former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev called for a preemptive craniotomy on Zelensky. Medvedev wrote on Telegram, "Zelensky announced the need for preventive nuclear strikes on Russia. Psychiatrists should perform a preemptive craniotomy on this idiot before he causes more trouble for his people and everyone else." Speaking at Australia's Lowy Institute via video link, Volodymyr Zelensky urged NATO to launch preemptive strikes on Russia instead of waiting for Russia's nuclear strikes. Zelensky said, what should NATO do? It should eliminate the possibility of Russia using nuclear weapons. But what is important, I once again appeal to the international community as it was before 24th of February. Preemptive strikes are important so that they know what will happen to them if nuclear weapons are used. It should not be vice versa, as is